that we're meeting on Indigenous lands, wherever our feet are planted in this country, and to pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'd like to welcome Ashley Gifney from the Burke Museum in Beechworth and Trevor Matthews from the Yakandanda Museum, obviously in Yakandanda. And I thank you very much for both of you for joining us today. In what I think of is something that really is crucial for all of us as we think about what stories do we leave behind? What's the legacy of both our lives and the lives that represent the time we're living in for those who will come after us? One of the things that interests me is that Australia Post is working with the National Archive to try to document everyday experiences of living with COVID. And I think it's probably the first time I've seen such a relationship take place. Certainly my memories of major events like Vietnam War, you know, even the recent bushfires, there wasn't a sense of trying to capture those everyday stories of what it was like to live through those momentous occasions. So Australia Post, as you know, has set up this Dear Australia letterbox and is asking people to document what their experience of living with COVID's been like. And so that's given us pause to think about how ideas of what matter and what's significant are changing over time, or have they? Are we still in our museums, both those in rural and regional parts of our country, as well as our national museums, still focused on the dare doings of great figures and predominantly still men? Or is that notion of what's worth preserving and what's worth saving and what's worth displaying and talking about changing? So I'd like to start by asking both of you, what do you think makes a person or event or even a document of significance for your museums? So what matters when you look at those people, events and documents to bringing them into the folds of a museum? So Ashley, we might start with you.
Yes, of course. Hello, everyone. So I guess for me, on a personal level, significance is not an absolute state. Rather, it's relative, it's contingent, and it's dynamic. Views on significance depend upon perspective and can definitely change over time. As a museum, what we tend to do is we follow a policy known as a collection policy that outlines our themes and our collecting processes. And within that, it contains you know, our understanding of significance, and that is really dependent upon our themes and our collecting habits. This is usually quite a common practice for museums, and because significance is so dynamic, we have to actually kind of tailor in what we collect, or else we could potentially collect everything if we were to define everything to have significance. So for us, we would look at experiences from the everyday life and acquire things, all sorts of things, not just physical objects, but obviously letters, but also digital pieces such as videos like this, for instance, is certainly something of interest to us because it's a moment in time in which we can reflect on in the future, and future generations can then access and understand what it was like, but also from another level can understand what was significant back in this day. So, yeah.
I'm muted, yes. I have a dog that every so often goes crazy, so I try to get in advance of her barking. Thank you, Ashley. I'd like to come back particularly to that idea of that you spoke about of themes and collecting practices and to talk perhaps a little bit about how they're set and who sets them and what criteria are used to set those sort of things. But Trevor, can you talk about from your perspective what makes something of significance?
Yep. I go to the matter that Ashley addressed of ending up trying to collect everything, and yet I think in a sense everything needs to be collected, and I know that's difficult, but I'll address that in a moment if you like. I think significance is ours to ascribe to things, but it is also the entitlement of future generations to ascribe significance to events or to documents or to people or to human endeavours. And if we don't collect everything, we're really saying to future generations, look, you might have a question, but we just can't help you answer it because we didn't bother to, or we decided not to collect some things which you might think are important. And so there is, I think, a sort of a moral argument that we owe it to the future to let them know as much as is possible about the present so that they can make sense of it too. Yes, we can try to make sense of things, but as soon as we decide that we don't think something's worth collecting, then we're really saying to the future, well, sorry, but there was no point you asking that question because we just weren't prepared to help. And if I can sort of illustrate that point, a local historian, Colin Barnard, has written a 10-volume history of Yakandanda. The text itself runs to a little over 8,400 pages. And then there are pages and pages of photographs and explanatory documents and the index and appendices and addenda. And so the whole thing probably comes out a little closer to 10,000 pages. And you might think, well, that's probably going to cover quite a lot of the story. But in that story, there's scant reference. I think there are two references to Spanish influenza. And I only mention that because we're looking at events today and thinking about events in the past. So we don't really know terribly much about Spanish influenza in Yakandanda because nobody bothered to collect it. Nobody thought it worth keeping letters about. Nobody thought it worth writing about, writing to newspapers about. So there is very little information. And we're being told, I suppose, that, well, we didn't think this was very important, so you probably won't get the chance to wonder whether it was very important. And that, I think, underlines the need to try to collect as much as is possible. And I know that's really difficult, but we should not jump off at any point in human endeavour and say, well, we won't do it because it's too difficult. We should try to work around that, try and find ways of working around that. And so I recall also a conversation which Susan Reynolds and I had late last year with people from Totally Renewable Yakandanda, whose entire existence is digital. And we want to find some ways into developing expertise in a digital collection and collecting digital information. And the very first question they asked us was, well, what do you want? And our answer has to be, I think, well, everything you've got, because we don't know whether in 2070 somebody will want to know how an organisation like that came about. But if they do want to know something about it, we want to be able to give them as much as possible. A bit easier to do with TRI because it's fairly brand new, because we know that it's got big digital archives of its own. Much more difficult if they'd been writing everything down, because as soon as one letter gets lost, something is lost. That sort of a statement of the obvious. But no, I go to the notion that we should try as hard as we can to collect as much as possible. We can say what's significant today, but we probably shouldn't be telling future generations, look, don't ask that question because we didn't think it was significant enough to keep anything about it.
So there's a real conundrum there, isn't there, between wanting to keep everything and not being able to keep everything. It's almost in some ways impossible to think of all of the stories that one event might stimulate. If you see the stories from a whole lot of different people's perspectives, I mean, just even taking that notion of the Spanish flu in Yakandanda, you know, whose voice gets heard in that? Do the people living by the creek, do they get asked? Do their voices get recorded? Do they get valued in the same way that perhaps the person who was the nursing superintendent at the hospital or the general practitioner would have, their story would have been valued? You know, I like that idea of putting oneself into the future and saying, if I'm here, in, you know, 400 years' time, what would I need to know? And that flips me back again to Ashley's comment about almost collecting through themes. So I want to think about how that thematicizing happens. Who decides that? Because I think that then shapes what's collected. So it comes back to Trevor's point about trying to get everything and not being able to keep everything. So having some decision points around those. So Ashley, can you talk a little bit about those, that notion of significance through themes?
Yes, definitely. So I guess it all comes out because collections, growing collections just use so much, it has so much demand on resources. It's just phenomenal how much it does have, time and energy and the ability to care for such growing collections. To be able to apply a theme to your collecting controls that process and then mitigates any risk that could potentially happen because of such a large and sprawling collection. Collecting themes are something that are put together in a collection policy, which is a formal documentation that accredits a museum. Within this collection policy, there are other elements such as loan procedures and deaccessioning procedures, exhibition procedures. It's basically the go-to thing. And what happens when you go to do accreditation is you conduct quite a bit of consultation, depending on what kind of institution you are. As a local museum, we would obviously be consulting with our council and our friends of the Burke and other community members and look at what this institution is, what it has been traditionally, and where we want to go forward as a museum. We were originally founded as an Athenaeum, so we were a museum of library books and lectures, and obviously we have changed quite considerably since then. Now we look at collecting contemporary pieces, and that wouldn't have been ascribed in our original collection policy. So that changes every 4 years when we go to reaccredit our museum and we have to republish our collection policy that looks at our collecting themes and what we want to collect. At the moment, our themes look at 19th century Beechworth and what that was like, and mining on the gold rush field. So that was kind of what we had in place previously. And now, as I'm actually doing reaccreditation, we're looking at, well, what do we want to collect today? This is our opportunity to kind of control these themes and bring in themes that we think and we hope will be, you know, draw some significance in the future. Because, yeah, like I said, you can't, it is desirable to collect everything, but at the moment I have about 4 different storage facilities, and with the collection growing, it's hard to keep up with the demands that these resources have with just one person.
So you turn to the friends of the museum to help you with those things?
Yes, definitely. The most important thing about collecting and themes of collecting is involving community. Having, in order to reduce bias or censorship or any kind of prejudice, we need to involve as many people as possible and have everyone express all their opinions and all their views and to come together and decide on what our key things are that we want to collect. Otherwise, if it was just up to me and I wanted to decide what I would want to collect, it would be hugely flawed. And I can't tell what the future will be like. So it's
And obviously being Beechworth and having that historical the story of Beechworth being so wrapped up in mining that and gold rush, that obviously has an influence. The very history of the place partly determines those things as well. Trevor, your practice, are you as interested in those accreditation processes and having those processes shape those themes of collecting?
I'm a sort of returned historian in the sense that I've worked with the Museum and the Historical Society in Yarkandandah in the the mid-80s, and it's only in the last couple of years that I've returned to the museum, which is accredited and which has its collections policy and faces all of the dilemmas that Ashley mentioned of what to collect. We sometimes let it be known that we're interested in just about anything, and sometimes that produces wicker baskets full of scraps and elements that we look at and think, well, that's not leaping out and saying, keep me. And yet, if you look at it for a moment, it's the kind of thing which a particular social class may have given as a valuable item as a wedding present 50 years ago. And so, you know, draw the line and say, well, this is worthy, this is unworthy. I just step aside for a moment from museums and think about the keeping of history. And I think all of us keep history. All of us keep letters. All of us keep artifacts that represent some moments in our time. I'm sure many of us as parents will have a plastic carton somewhere with the first pair of booties and a couple of the children's books from way back. And we are, in that sense, collectors. That means, of course, that we have attached significance to certain things, but that collection in itself has value. And so it poses a challenge to us. What will we do with it? And thinking about the sorts of things that we might as individuals keep, or that we might as a workplace want to keep, which can contribute to the Australian story. If Jenny Donnelly were to keep a week's record of the searches that she made at her workstation in the course of her working week, and also kept recordings of a couple of Zoom meetings. Not everything, but there may come a time when somebody wants to know, how did people work during the 2020s? And may also want to know, how did they work during the COVID period? And Jenny's collection of those sorts of things may be as valuable as Daniel Andrews' press conferences in trying to understand how people responded to the crisis. But if Jenny doesn't collect that and nobody else does, then that's a perspective that's lost. And so I go back to my earlier point about trying to collect everything, acknowledging how difficult that is, and then trying to find ways of collecting some so that as many perspectives as possible are available. Now, what happens to them and where the repository is another question. I did suggest earlier that we shouldn't balk at it because it's difficult, but it is a challenge for the sector. And the sector has mighty challenges in front of us. Susan Reynolds and I wrote a paper over several months, late last year, early this year, about challenges facing small museums. And we discovered the work of Kylie Winkworth, who is a scholar in the field. And her fear is that the field is almost rampant. There are so many museums and collections and archives and specialities that we have, by some estimates 1,200, by other estimates about 3,500 museums in Australia. But we have many, many, many more collections than that. And significant to the practical problem is the fact that 80% of the personnel who work in museums are in fact volunteers. And there would be people in this group who understand that volunteers are at risk by virtue of age of ceasing to be available as volunteers. That's another problem. As 100 museums bloom, 100 lots of decisions bloom with them. And it does become a little rampant. It's a challenge. It's a huge challenge, but everything's got some value.
So it almost feels like we all need to have an historian's mindset when we think about how we record and store the stories of our own lives. Is that what, in some ways, you're suggesting as well?
I think that's true. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think many of us will have had a moment to look at a family Bible and be grateful for the list of names written in the front of it, whether we ascribe to that faith or some other faith. But wherever our families have documented things, there is a resource that we might not otherwise have had. And I think we owe it to our grandchildren and their grandchildren to enable them to have some sense. I think it's important. Plenty of other people would say, we move on. But from an historian's point of view, I think it counts for something.
Mm. Actually, how important are those everyday stories of residents of Beechworth or even visitors to Beechworth in the collection that you have responsibility for?
Well, it's very true. I have a very strong responsibility to constantly collect, and the way in which I collect and what I collect also varies. And collecting the stories, the current stories and stories of people who still are with us today, it's crucial. And one of the main methods in which I approach this is through recording through oral histories. Mm-hmm. And that is a really effective way to put down in a recording, but also transcribe their stories and retain that information for future generations to access. It's especially as we are, you know, mostly our community museums, collecting these stories will, you know, we're not sure whether they'll be, you know, right now have a great deal of significance, but, you know, as Trevor says, as time progresses, things gain significance, and we can't foretell what someone will want to research in the future and find that information so invaluable to whatever they need from it. So it's a very crucial practice of mine.
Because many of us grow up, I guess, with those you know, stories of the daring doers of great deeds as the stories that matter, and there's less emphasis placed on those, you know, everyday stories. You know, I like the, you know, Trevor's example of taking a snapshot of Jenny's working life to say these are the sorts of things that might be recorded and might find some way of being stored. So, you know, how do you stimulate that interest in people to go be in some ways beyond an oral history, because an oral history almost sometimes becomes a story of an event or a and then I did and then I did and then I did and then I did. Whereas encapsulating it around this was working life in this week and getting some rich evidence, I guess, built into that is a sort of slightly different than taking a longer view of an oral history. That was a bit of a rambling question, I'm sorry.
No, I know where you're getting at. It's very true. I mean, history traditionally has been written by the winners, you know, and we want to showcase all the other stories. For me, as a collection manager, the way I approach collecting these stories is building rapport, is going out to the community, is meeting people, talking to people. It's actually building relationships, and it's building community and building trust. And that way we can then take steps further into how we can capture this. And it gives us a perspective and understanding of what it is like for them, and then approach it from what would be the best way to capture that information. Is it through an oral history? Is it through a photo? Is it through an object that they can donate? Engaging with people and creating something that's, you know, a really wonderful experience can help, you know, build the collection into this really, obviously really in-depth and, you know, historically relevant information, and, you know, hold that information for the future. So it's that tends to be the way I approach it. And fortunately, I'm a very people person, so I like to go around and talk to people. And recently I've been engaging with you know, some of the, you know, a cafe in Beechworth, and just talking about, you know, what it's been like them for them, and down the track maybe I you know, I can invite them to come around and I can just have a chat. And, you know, maybe the outcome is I collect a cup, but I've got a story with that cup and what that represents. And that tends to be how the approach. Sorry, I just answered in a rambling way as well. So
okay. Because it strikes me that you know, when I think of the reason, not just COVID but the bushfires, that, you know, as an academic, I'm used to taking a research perspective, but there's a difference between taking a sort of research lens into coming into a setting like how did ordinary people manage and respond to bushfires, to the preceding drought and to COVID afterwards. There's so many events in that. But how do we capture those or see those as valuable is important.
Trevor, I'll just jump in there. Oh, sorry.
No, off you go.
I was just going to mention, because Trevor mentioned earlier, Kylie Winkworth. So a really good tool for measuring something of value or of significance is a published work by Kylie Winkworth and Rosalind Russell. They wrote Significance 2.0, and it's a guide to assessing the significance of a collection. And it helps pave way into researching and understanding the significance of something like an event that you can then draw collection from. Sorry, I just jumped in there just to say
yeah, that. Yeah, that's okay.
An approach.
Yeah. Well, if I took an opportunity then to pull two of those things together, Kathleen, you mentioned the bushfires and Ashley, significance. And if we attach significance to the bushfires, as we must, we might then consider the way people got through everyday life, but also how people moved past them. And I'm thinking about a person I worked with at Myrtleford for some years who, along with two or three other artists in Beechworth, decided after the first of the big bushfire seasons that they would draw or write something every day about where they were at in the 12 months following it. And they did keep it going for 12 months. And I've seen some of the artwork. I haven't read too much of that stuff, but it's an extraordinary collection of images of fire, of matches burning out, of the passage of time, and therefore perhaps the easing of the strength of the emotion in the first place. And that's a remarkable historical resource because it's very much an interpretation, as distinct from just collecting stuff, very much an interpretation. And in my time at Myrtleford, when the first of those fire seasons came, we were planning a project for many of the older migrants who lived in a retirement village in Myrtleford that had just opened up. And we were going to put the question to them, if you could take one thing, thinking that they might reflect on what they would have brought as migrants. But the question took on a whole different meaning. If you could take one thing because your house was about to go up in flames, what would you take? And that was the key into recording those experiences. And it was conducted by Year 9 students in interviews, and there was a lovely presentation of the outcome of that work. So the doing of history is an activity that takes place all the time in many places and can be approached in very different ways, remembering that both of those activities are interpreting and therefore selecting, which is a little bit different from just collecting and keeping, which makes it possible for somebody else to interpret, is another little ramble.
Yeah, no, we're doing well. I'd like to, of course, open the discussion up to everyone that's on the Zoom. So if you have any comments or questions, as you can tell, you don't have to have fully formed articulate questions to be part of this, but we'd certainly welcome your contribution. Jenny, have we got anything at the moment that you need to draw our attention to?
Well, interestingly, Maria, seen as Damien on the screen, but Maria nonetheless, has earlier before that previous conversation made a comment around, first of all, engaging people in aged care, if that happened, that might happen, engaging them with collections and their thoughts. And the other one was with schools and perhaps the potential to link, which is exactly what Trevor's just described. So do you want to say anything more about that?
Me or Damien?
We'll start with Maria. Is there anything you wanted to add to Jenny's comment of your comment?
No, thanks, Trevor. And I think I didn't realise that was happening, which is really good. And, and the importance of connecting, you know, our kids to history and being part of it and sharing it. And because we lose too many stories, and it's as Ashley mentioned, it's not always the winning story. It can be something else, but they're very important stories to capture. And I guess yeah, what else can we do as a community to support the museums and the work that's being done, and what can we do to share what you have there at the moment, perhaps. So, yeah.
Mm. Matthew, Trevor, do you want to...
I'll just make an observation about that. Something which, again, Susan and I talk about often is changing nature of access to knowledge. And in some respects, Trove is a most wonderful resource and also a most threatening resource, because Trove means that you don't need to bother to go to your museum. You can look up the documents that have been scanned in somewhere else by somebody else. And so you can do your history, and things like Ancestry.com do the same thing. You can do your history by getting somebody else to do some of the history for you, or you can do it all from home. And so you don't really need to go to a museum, which is quite sad from a research and a knowledge point of view. But as with Ashley's comments earlier, museums are building interpretations of themes and presenting something to their communities. And so we're offering something, we're putting it out there. How successful we are in getting people to come in is another question altogether. And in these days, it's even more difficult. I think it's three at a time at the moment, isn't it, Sue? Yeah.
So in thinking about the way those museums are curated, how do you decide what to display even? What sets up that exhibition? What are the decisions and criteria that you use in doing that?
Ashley?
Well, this is a question a little bit out of my field, as I'm very tailored towards collection management, which is basically very much the behind the scenes stuff. So we have an experienced curator who builds exhibitions, events and programs. She responds when she looks at building at something. It's usually a response to something in current today, something that's relevant, something to celebrate, something to mourn, something to acknowledge, because there is a strong relevance or there is a significance that needs to be told. The process in which we, in choosing items, is there's a lot of, again, I guess a consultation process internally, which would involve looking at our collection, drawing things out that are relevant to whatever the exhibition is, and discussing what that means and how it can be interpreted, or how we can change its interpretation to look at something else and challenge our audiences to think outside the box. My side of things tends to be the kind of the preservation and the care, and very much the science behind museums. But yeah, that's, I guess, the way we tend to work.
Trevor, do you have the opportunity of building exhibition spaces and changing them? And
well, I have had, and I suppose as a voluntary organisation, we rely in some respects on the enthusiasms and the passions of the volunteers who may come forth and say, I'd really like to learn the story of current exhibition, the pubs in Yakandanda. And that led to the current exhibition, and it was driven very much by a person who was prompted in that direction, and built slowly a team of people around her, and together they put together the current exhibition. I know that person is also interested in industrial accidents in mining, and that may lead to another exhibition. But take that person away, and there is a challenge to the committee of management to say, all right, well, what are we going to do? We don't want our collection to be stagnant. We want it to tell a story to our community. What stories have we told? What stories haven't we told? Is there an answer to the question, what will we do next, that comes out of that conversation?
Mm.
A little more random. Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite...
Go on, Ashley.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because, you know, they say only 5% of a collection is only ever on display in any museum at any one time. And, you know, having temporary exhibitions that revolve on an annual basis is an opportunity to kind of to share the collection and to share the stories. It's something that the Burke Museum, and what I'm quite passionate about, is digitizing these collections and I am working on Victorian collections to publish all 30,000 objects in our collection. And we're finding that people are really drawn to this website, and they're looking at these photos of our collection, and they're contacting us, and they're wanting to do research, they're wanting to come to the museum, and they want to see them in person. And I guess, so that's one way in which I guess I have an exhibition's role or functional purpose as a collections manager, and that's sharing on a digital format. Yeah. Mm. Mm.
Kathleen, Sophie has a question, a query around the hard to reach groups, perhaps the people Sophie. You'll hear from much.
Really interesting discussion. Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, who's talking about traditionally history and museums being about the most important stories that you were talking about before. Do you think, or is there much sort of focus on getting stories, artefacts, getting the history of people from harder to reach or hardly reached kind of communities within the area? And do you think that's currently being done well?
If I jump in the last couple of years, we have the Historical Society in Yakandanda and the museum have worked with Arts Yakandanda and the theatre group and produced two performances of monologues. The first were seven people who were buried in the cemetery in Yakandanda, and the second were people who at the time were living in Yakatoon. Were they hard to reach? The living people weren't hard to reach, but in the selection of people for the first group of stories was the tale of a mother who in falling upon hard times with a large family and then passing away, would have seen her children all end up effectively as criminals, because to be impoverished was a crime at the time, and being broken up as a family and dragged across different parts of Victoria, starting in Melbourne in various sorts of homes and services that catered as they did then. So that was a way of getting the stories of people who are out of the way characters. She wasn't a significant member of the community, but she was a real person with real kids, and her story could be told in that way. Another character in that series of monologues was a young woman who married a Chinese fellow, and the experience she had of needing to try to give him a child, and her carrying a child which was stillborn. An incredibly poignant story of a very obscure person who, had that project not begun, would have never have even been a footnote in history. She would have been a gravestone that people would have wondered about as they walked by. So a museum can therefore open its doors to quite creative ways of telling stories of the souls who are otherwise never rank in the histories of our society, certainly not in the way history from the 18th, 19th century was written by winning men about winning men. So it can be done. It required, in that case, some very creative people wanting to do the research, wanting to tell a story, and then finding a vehicle through which to tell the story. Can be done. Difficult gig for a museum to do all of it on its own, but when a museum can work with other groups in a community, then that possibility exists. And in the same way as I spoke earlier about putting school children in with groups of people, there's a different kind of pressure of expectation in a setting like that, where stories can unfold more readily than they might when I, as adult male, go into a room and say, "Now I'm going to ask you some questions, give me some answers." You know, it's about being creative about how you get the stuff that you want people to tell you. Can be done. It's hard.
Ashley, do you want to add to that? Yeah, I totally agree. Like, it's it is a creative approach, and it is about you know, a lot of museums have collection managers or curators who work on site and work with the harder reach communities to build engagement, to build trust, to develop programs in which they can assist not only themselves for a collecting purpose and for a museum person purpose, but, you know, to look at what their current state is, and help and assist in whatever format or way in which they do need, if that is the outcome in which, you know, the curator wishes to assist in. And again, just as Trevor said, it comes down to awareness, you know, it comes down to research, it comes down to the museum knowing and having the drive to want to pursue such a direction and to highlight the story and to keep it in memory for the future. Yeah.
And I think whenever somebody walks in and says, I'm really interested in doing this, you almost have to wrap them up right there and then it's like, you're in. You know? We will do this thing.
Can I add a comment to that,
yep,
please? Susan Reynolds, we also need, as you've been pointing out, to actively seek and work with those extra creative people. Now, the last word I would use about myself is creative, but like Ashley, I can do a collection and collection management, but creativity is somewhere that's found, and Trevor talked about the monologues. Now, after the 2003 fires, some of you will remember that Murray Arts did a play about the fires in this part of the world, which was incredibly powerful. They did a lot of work with that. They also used, I think, social services to assist them with the storytelling part and the interviews of that. And of course they had writers, and then the play was something that everybody involved, of course, went to a million times. And the other avenue, of course, is historical fiction, or in fact, writing about events. Now, a case in point is a book I've just read called A Dictionary of Lost Words, which is just a magnificent story of how language has changed and how it has been accessed by different strata of people than the people who are actually first setting up the dictionary. And museums need to engage with those sort of people in our community who probably don't think of themselves as museum people. But if we talk if we think of it all as stories, it's much more accessible.
Yeah, the Dictionary of Lost Words in particular is, if anyone hasn't read it,
it's fantastic.
Words excluded by men. And the point is so powerfully made, I think. Words about women by women. On the matter of the sorts of things that we might think about that we already have as examples of history, if we recall the events of 2014, the anniversary of the outbreak of the Great War, it's only 19 years and 1 month and a few days from the centenary of the outbreak of the Second War. So we'll all be scurrying about trying to find letters from somebody from the front, which will be another shot in the arm to see what else is there. And that will be interesting, because we've given the Great War such status for such a time that what comes out of the woodwork or out of the cobwebs to tell the story of life on the home front in that war will be quite a challenge for families, for museums, for the entire glam sector.
And it draws us back to that comment about how do we all see ourselves as historians, and how do we value our own collections, if you like. You know, I feel like I need to confess this, but when my mother was unable to care for herself at home, and her many daughters, the two old ones in particular, were being very officious in their cleaning up, they took two huge big drawers that she had. She had very few clothes, but in her drawers she had lined up every letter one of her sisters had ever sent her, and they just went shook with the whole lot into the bin. Only to be approached sometime later by an archivist because her sister was a nun, and the archivist was very interested in documenting the relationship between family members of nuns. So my mother's history of those letters went, I don't know how far back they went, I never saw them. So, you know, sometimes we don't value the very things that we have with us. So is one role then of museums to try to teach us about how to document and store or consider our own collections as collections?
Well, to teach, but certainly to remind. If you've got one of those sorts of collections, don't throw it out. you're right. There has to be a way that that museums and historical societies can find of encouraging people. Maybe it's a show and tell. Maybe it's a antique roadshow moment where we invite a community to bring in one thing which they think says something profound about their own community. But that would never be a one-off. It could never be a one-off, because a one-off just doesn't serve the purpose. It ought to be a rolling roadshow. Susan and I spent some time last week speaking to the students at Yakandanda Primary School about a project they wanted to do this term, and that was to create their own museum. And one of the first thoughts that we had was to try and encourage them to restrict themselves in some way. They were looking at a representation of several hundred years of Australian history, and we thought, well, maybe concentrate on sporting footwear, or concentrate on, you know, small toys, or what you get at Macca's, you know, and those silly little plastic bags that will last forever. But do represent what somebody once thought was an important little book for young people. We have a bit, proactivity is there, isn't it? It's just waiting. Just waiting.
Yeah.
Kathleen, Cecily's brought up a very valid point, and that is around the role that local newspapers have played in capturing local stories. And
Cecily, do you want to?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go on.
Cess?
Coming. All right. Sorry. Oh, yeah. No, really, it was just a passing comment. Because I know that, you know, when we want to find something out about what's happened locally, the newspapers is often a really good place to start. And I know one of my friends had this beautiful article that went back to her mother, her mother's experience in the 30s of having a bridal shower thrown by her friends, and what they had for their afternoon tea and the games that they played. And it was priceless. And it was written up in the local newspaper. we're not going to see anything, even probably the locals, you know, the scores of the football might not even be accessible, let alone, you know, who biffed who on the chin and whose grandmother was there to sort them out with an umbrella, you know. the flavour that we get from our local newspapers is I think, a treasure, which I haven't thought of until now in terms of the discussion about media and representation of local lives. Mm.
And what we lose now that they're being closed.
And what they reflect.
The kind of social, cultural, and political, you can reflect over these newspapers over 100 years and look how the influences of the 20s evolved stories about women and umbrellas, or in the 30s and how it was about a particular costume, and it changes. And I guess when we draw comparison from today and back in the 1920s, it's very drastically different. And I think it's quite interesting, the stories that are captured today, because although they may not look quite, you know, as wonderful as a little story or an excerpt about a picnic, in 100 years' time, they may think this Zoom meeting is the most beautiful thing that they've ever seen. And so, newspapers play a really vital role in capturing these stories. Yeah, it's great.
Equally, as we see newspapers decline in importance and see the ascent of digital presentations of information about everything, finding ways of capturing and keeping digital information is a new and big challenge. It'll be on the web. Well, that's fine as long as it stays on the web and as long as you can access it. If a business changes its web page, then if you haven't got a record of its first web page, then that's something that you've lost. And so we would be missing an opportunity to see how people's representations of themselves in electronic media changes over time? And that's another historical question that we couldn't ask if we can't, now I think the term is harvest social media. It sounds like it's possible if somebody would leave the cloud alone and keep everything in there and give everyone a password, then it sounds like it's possible. But that does seem a little unlikely. And it also seems that we would want to be a little bit more selective if we want to collect digital representations about our own communities. But we have to do it, and we have to start doing it as early as we can, because we have to admit now that if we haven't recorded the first attempts at web pages, we'll probably never get them back. And that's something else that we will have missed.
Facebook, as somebody, as Sophie has said, the community Facebook pages are a really great innovation. But I just wonder, you know, if it's all online, we're not actually saving it in print or saving it in hard copy, and it all requires, you know, electronic access. And I think that could be ephemeral, potentially.
Another problem, I think. Ashley?
Well, it's actually quite interesting you saying that, because it's a lot of museums, you can actually archive Facebook pages. And I know, I think it's Melbourne Museum, they started up a page about people writing about their experiences about COVID-19, similar to the Australia Post program. But this is just a Facebook page. And so they've set an open date and a closed date. And what they're going to do is they're going to complete it and file it. And so they're archiving all sorts of multimedia or digital experiences, and they are cataloging it in their catalog. So they will be able to access it, not from online, but from their catalog. And that way that information is preserved for future generations without the fear of the internet blowing up type thing. So it's it is one method museums have really jumped on. And, you know, the wonderful thing about museums is they're so innovative, and they're always forward thinking and trying to improve and to use the resources that are current and develop ways in which we can store information. So I believe museums were one of the first industries to actually adopt the use of computers. So it was, we have a huge role to, a responsibility to continue that innovation.
And of course, the other collection of digital information that we can't imagine keeping will be our email correspondence with everyone we know, and our text messages to everyone we know, which take the place of the letters that once sat in the back of a drawer that were once thrown away. And of course, there is a lost resource, a huge lost resource of how we communicated with each other, let alone what we communicated about, and how precious the letters are that we see from years gone by, is, I think, fairly well known to everyone. But that won't occur. It won't keep on occurring unless somebody says, I'm going to cache every email, and I will say to my great-grandchildren, release that to the museum 50 years after I'm gone. And if it's of any interest, and if it's not, they can delete it. But if we don't do that, it's just another lost opportunity and a lost resource.
And look, that's something that we do in our museum as well, is that we may have email correspondence, but it may not be catalogued as a record. It may be included in finding information about a particular object and having email correspondence with that donor or that owner or someone who was relevant to it, and putting that information in with the record. Then we have that permanency of that email correspondence, and maybe later down the track they'll want to subtract that email and record it as a collection item. So I guess, you know, going all the way back to the start, it's about collecting everything, and it's about maybe not recording it as each as a separate item, but storing that information in the relevant fields so people can access it in the future.
And about having that, what I'm now thinking of as a collector's mindset. So I love the idea of a roadshow as a regular, you know, event, you know, bring out your wares, sort of, you know, thematized, you know, you could have one every month or something at the museum where you get that opportunity. And it as a way of almost schooling us in thinking about our own histories and how we share them or not with family members. And often it's sometimes easier to tell a story to somebody else rather than to one's family as well, so that you can get through some of those filters that exist in families.
Yeah, I think of it in terms of us all being participants in our own life performance, and to the extent that we try to make sense of that, we are being historians. That's what it is to be an historian, to make sense of an experience. Well, take note of all of the above.
Yes. And we're going to do a snapshot of Jenny's week at work and bring it up to the museum.
And look, case in point, you know, that may be interesting to people who want to study work, but it is also just a moment in time of a person alive. And that's inherently valuable anyway.
Kathleen, I was going to say, before COVID started, at the start of the year, a family member and I just decided for one whole year we would stop texting and doing it the way we do, and we actually write weekly letters to each other.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
And for that very reason of, you know, in years to come, we'll kind of be able to, you know, sit back as old people and maybe have a laugh and reflect on the year. But now I've noticed the letters are getting more personal, I suppose, about kind of our feelings around COVID. And, you know, I'm probably pouring my heart out more than I would have if I was talking to that person on the phone or sending a text. So we didn't plan out for any of this to happen, but it's actually been quite a nice moment, I suppose, in time. And all of a sudden I get very excited when the mail lady drives past, because I kind of wait in anticipation. I haven't had a letter this week and I'm kind of getting a bit frustrated that it arrived, but it's been quite a nice experience. And I think
in how good is that?
It'll be something we can look back on.
Yeah, all I get are bills.
My mother was a Sunday letter writer. Sunday, you know, we'd all be taken to church and then we would come home and she would get lunch ready, which was always the big roast. And then Sunday afternoon was letter writing, and she used to set up the ironing board and write letters to her sisters on the ironing board. And so I assume that was the day they all wrote to each other and there was an exchange of letters. I know my first husband used to always do a little drawing on the notes. He left a note. We worked shift work and he left a note every time he was leaving, and I was still in bed, and, you know, I didn't keep any of them. And so, you know, when he died, I thought that was such a, you know, I miss that little, he always had these stupid little drawings that sometimes would drive me demented, but I miss being made demented by them now. But because they're very, I think texting changes the nature of how we think and what we write and what we say. So it does alter. So, yeah. It's been a fascinating discussion. I've really enjoyed it. And I'll rethink about what my collection of stuff in that box under the bed represents. So thank you both, Trevor and Ashley. I look forward to visiting your museums now with a renewed interest and a renewed sense of respect for the work that you're doing. And I thank you for that. I think it's going to be valuable, not for just for us, but for those generations ahead to come. Next week, Jenny, I've forgotten who we've got. I haven't got my sheet of paper with me. I cleaned up my desk, but
and I can't remember either. But I will send it out to everyone.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for your patience, members of the audience.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I ask everyone to just put their quick evaluation into the chat function? So those who haven't been with us before, it's a sentence or a word or two or a sentence into the chat function as how you found today's session, what you thought about today's session. We are going through to the end of August, and we'll finish up on the last Thursday of August will be our last for this series. And who knows if there'll be a second series, but I thank you all for taking part in today's session, and I look forward to seeing you next week. So take care.
Oh, and
wear masks.
Wear masks.